Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into one subject in depth, and that is the American Empire and the conflicting forces within it, state versus defense. We will speak with the author of an important new book that not only reveals the hidden history of manipulation and miscalculation that changed the Republic into an empire, but we'll look into the extent to which the empire is destroying the Republic, and finally ahead to what might be the final folly of empire, a war between the United States and China. Stephen Glane, the author of a new book, State versus Defense, The Battle to Define America's Empire, joins us for an extended in-depth interview into our foreign policy, what shaped it, who controls it, and how it can be changed before it's too late. Joining us now is author and journalist Stephen Glane, who was a journalist for the South China Morning Post before joining the Wall Street Journal, where he became a foreign correspondent covering Asia and the Middle East from bases in Seoul, Tokyo, Tel Aviv, and Amman. He is the author of Mullahs, Merchants, and Militants, The Economic Collapse of the Arab World, which was named the best book of 2004 by online magazine The Globalist, and Stephen Glane's latest book, State versus Defense, The Battle to Define American Empire. And it's the most important work available to understand not just the struggle between America's diplomats and warriors, but it shows how the American Empire was created through manipulation and miscalculation, leading us to the present moment where we are militarily overstretched in losing wars, economically downgraded, and morally tainted by a misguided war on terror. But that does not mean the Pentagon is not gearing up for another war with China. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Glane.
Thank you, and it's good to be here.
I was giving a brief summary of the book in the sense that it covers so much territory, and it's such an important piece of work and so vital, I think, for people to understand where we are in terms of our foreign policy. And, of course, we have certainly enough challenges on the domestic front. But given that we've got 190,000 troops and 115,000 civilian employees inside 909 military facilities in 46 countries, and we're spending five times the combined annual security budget of China, Russia, Cuba, Iran, and North Korea, it makes it hard to understand how we can sustain the American dream at home at the same time as the American empire abroad.
Well, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, because having lived abroad and having seen on an intimate basis how preponderant our military presence is around the world, it dawned on me that this is more consistent with an empire rather than a republic. And I want to share that perspective.
Well, I think it's you've done a very, very valuable job here, Stephen Glane, in taking us back to the foundations of the American empire, particularly going back to George Kennan's containment doctrine, also the period of the Marshall Plan. What I always found so extraordinary about that period when the Cold War began was that it wasn't what George Kennan had in mind in terms of containment. He didn't want right. deterrence to become an open-ended racket where there was never such thing as enough deterrence. So he kept building more missiles, right. submarines, bombers, etc. But also, my understanding is that what Stalin was most afraid of was the Marshall Plan. He didn't care about the weapons because that just gave him an excuse to build a police state at home.
That's true. In fact, that's why the Soviets declined an offer by George Marshall to become part of or beneficiary of the Marshall Plan. You're absolutely right.
So how did we get wrong-footed from day one? Is it that simple that the military-industrial complex that had made so much money in World War II thought, well, you know, maybe we should keep this thing going?
I think you could track it, or the reference points really begin when Britain approached the United States in a very solemn, dramatic way and appealed to Washington to assume their burden of supporting pro-Western governments in Greece and Turkey. You may recall that was really the impetus behind the Truman Doctrine. The Truman White House was told that unless we were to stump up hundreds of millions of dollars in order to support the governments in Greece and Turkey, that they would go communist, they would be tucked inside the Soviet Empire, and the fight would almost be over right there. It was appeal to our worst fears. And in fact, as I found out researching the book, the so-called threats to these two governments were nominal, were not at all serious. But London succeeded in getting the Americans to assume this burden, and that became the Truman Doctrine. And that, it then became policy to contest Soviet adventurism all over the world. As you point out, Stalin's ambitions were more focused on keeping his own people pliant and well-behaved than he was about hegemony abroad.
Well, one of the really interesting things about your book, Stephen Glean, State versus Defense, The Battle to Define America's Empire, is from the very beginning with the bomb, which we had a monopoly over, albeit a short-lived one, Henry Stimson, the Secretary of War, wanted to internationalize the bomb, warning it would lead to a desperate arms race. And, of course, that's what happened. But then you outline a series of what I referenced in the opening as both manipulations and miscalculations. The U.S. decision to isolate Mao Zedong led to he appealed to the United States. He wanted to do business. He was more afraid of the Soviet Union than the United States. And we rebuffed him, and that led to the Korean and Vietnam Wars. And then the coup against Mossadegh, which resulted in Iran, which has resulted in so much of the blowback we have today. Lyndon Johnson's decision to militarize the U.S. role in Vietnam to contain the Sino-Soviet pact that didn't even exist.
That's right.
So there's a series of all of these incidents where the American people were told one thing and something else was happening. But at the bottom line was these were huge blunders. So, again, it gets me to trying to figure out in this tension between diplomats and military guys. I mean, it's pretty clear that the military guys get their way. But are they just stupid or are they mendacious in the sense that the more paranoia we have, the more militarism we need, the more weapons we have, the more we become important?
Well, I would point out, first of all, if I may just follow up with what you were saying, it's important to know that at every inflection point in the Cold War when a president was deliberating over whether or not to go with a military option or a diplomatic one, there was always a cadre of American diplomats or military attachés or spies on the ground where the crisis was evolving, basically putting the president straight, telling him how it was. But unfortunately, political imperatives in Washington would discourage the president from listening. And this is the case with Korea, this is the case with Vietnam, and certainly was the case with Iraq many years later. Again, there's always somebody there who gets it, but they're overridden by the politics of Washington, D.C., and that's something we always have to keep in mind. Also, in terms of the military getting their way, as you put it, one thing that struck me when I was researching the book is that it was, in fact, usually civilians in the Pentagon or civilians in the White House or lawmakers in Capitol Hill who created this inertial thrust against diplomatic remedies to diplomatic challenges for the sake of militarization. And these are people who really, from James Forrestal, who effectively hijacked Kennan's containment doctrine for his own militaristic ends, to Walt Rostow, who urged Lyndon Johnson to militarize the war in Vietnam, to, of course, the neoconservatives of the Bush administration. Are they stupid? I wouldn't say stupid. I would say parochial. They have they all have one thing in common. It's a very narrowly informed view of the world, and that, I think, nurtures this kind of paranoia. We tend to fear things we don't know, and the problem with this parade of personalities from Forrestal, say, to Dick Cheney, is if you lack the curiosity to learn about what's going on, if you decline to approach the various challenges with an empathic understanding of what the other side is doing, why they're doing it, then a militaristic solution or approach is inevitable.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Glean, the author of State versus Defense, The Battle to Define America's Empire. Years ago, I spoke at length with Paul Nitzer, who was one of the architects
of course.
Much of this Cold War. And he actually told me something that kind of goes against his record. As you know, he created the Committee on the Present Danger, which was the precursor to the mm-hmm. to the neocons. I think largely at a peak because President Jimmy Carter didn't invite him in. And, of course, Carter wasn't the smartest politician. He should have had the guy inside the tent instead of outside the tent causing trouble.
Right.
But he did, said to me once, that during the Cold War, during the most profligate part of the Cold War, when the Soviets were active in Africa and various other places, some of the smarter people inside the defense and diplomatic establishment came up with a theory of geopolitical indigestion, meaning that let the Soviets take over every third world country,
right,
and they'll bankrupt themselves much quicker, which they ultimately did.
Exactly.
But I said, well, why? What happened to that idea? And he said, well, it's just far too subtle for U.S. foreign policy. and I'm also reminded of the phone recordings of LBJ talking to Senator Russell about the Vietnam War early in the piece, saying, what the hell's going on here? We're not winning. You know, I got this sergeant here, and he's going over there, and he's got kids and stuff. I mean, it was very, very, you know, makes you think the president of the United States is embarking on a huge mistake. He knows it's a mistake, but yet he feels he can't do anything about it.
Lyndon Johnson is, I think, the perfect example of a very strong-willed individual, a cunning politician, who was rendered prostrate by this relentless push for militarization. He knew he wanted his Great Society programs, and he knew the only way he could get them is by protecting his flank against accusations from the right that he was being soft on communism. And as a result, in 1965, he deployed the Marines to Da Nang, and that was the beginning of our long and painful involvement in Vietnam.
In doing this very important book, Stephen Glane, State vs. Defense, The Battle that Defined America's Empire, clearly you're trying to provide the public with the historical record, but also the historical lesson, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, unfortunately, we haven't even scratched the surface. We're only at the Vietnam War. One of the chapters in the book is something that I've been aware of for some time, is that there was almost a nuclear war in November of 1983. And that was connected to the Reagan military buildup, where the gerontocracy in the Kremlin actually believed when Reagan said, you're going to end up on the ash heap of history. Theirs was a system that couldn't distinguish between rhetoric and reality because it was built on lies.
Right.
So they take rhetoric seriously because it's almost more real to them than reality.
That's exactly what's happening between the U.S. and China today, but we can get to that later on.
So that was the result of the, of course, there was a good ending to it in this match. I think it was the Abel Archer almost nuclear war in 83 did shake Reagan up personally.
And
he realized how close we came.
That was a revelation in my searching a book. I have to give Reagan credit. He alone, really among his advisors, was able to feel empathy for the Soviets. It was such a shock to him that anyone could see United States is a threat, but he noted in his diary that this is definitely something we need to think about, and I think it was so unsettling for him in addition to other events which occurred in a very concentrated manner in that fall of 1983. That's why he was so receptive when the Soviets appealed to him to discuss weapons reduction.
Well, he was having fun, the actor was having fun taunting the wounded bear, but when it almost resulted in a nuclear war over perceptions, not reality, he really did. He had to wait till Gorbachev to come along, but then he really hit the ground running, and you do have to give him credit, both he and Gorbachev.
Gorbachev especially, I was struck at just how single-minded he was in trying to get the Americans to concentrate on the issue and to make good on their not commitments, but expressions of support for negotiations. But the two of them, I don't think one could have prevailed without the other, and they both made history. Mm.
Well, just to briefly and let the audience know about what we're talking about here, which is in the book, we're talking about State versus Defense, The Battle to Define America's Empire, Stephen Glane's book. In the fall of 83, there was a double agent inside the KGB in London who was kept warning for 2 years prior to that the United States and the West were digging its own grave by upping the nuclear ante. They were creating a situation where it's like the two nuclear gunfighters are facing off. And even though a nuclear war was unthinkable, there's a certain logic of if you think the other side's going to strike you in a preemptive first strike, then you preempt the preemption by beating them to the draw. And that became the conditions in the fall during a NATO exercise called Abel Archer that the Soviets honestly believed that it was a springboard for a real attack. And they prepared to launch a preemptive nuclear war. And fortunately, at the last minute, Reagan and company didn't go to their nuclear bunkers. The KGB, who were watching it, realized that it was an exercise. But it was a defining moment for President Reagan.
I'd also, just to extend that, you know, we're very fortunate that we now have transcripts of the various meetings that take you into the room when Reagan and Gorbachev were negotiating at Reykjavik. And it's really striking how passionate they all were. And I can't I really can't imagine another meeting between two powers, or obviously because we live in a unipolar world, but just the depths of conviction and passion and willing to compromise and this meeting between these two men from completely different backgrounds is really fascinating.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Glane, the author of this brand new book, State versus Defense, The Battle to Define America's Empire. Extremely important and valuable book in terms of understanding where we stand in our foreign policy as we appear to be in a moment where our military is overstretched, we're losing wars, we've been economically downgraded at home, facing a double-dip recession, and of course morally tainted by the misguided war on terror. And all of these are leading to a certain sense of loss of status around the world. And the book is very important to understand how we reach this point. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Stephen Glane in a moment. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm joined by Stephen Glane, a journalist and author of the brand new book, State versus Defense, The Battle to Define America's Empire. We're sort of going chronologically through the book and through our history here of how this military empire grew, even though, as you mentioned, throughout the period, there was always behind the scenes these titanic battles between diplomats and military over the directions we go and the steps we take. Invariably, the military won the battles. Tell us about, though, how these two latest wars that we got into, the war on drugs and the war on terror, have been so destructive and misguided.
I'm glad you brought that up about the war on drugs, because that doesn't get nearly enough attention as it should. As I understand it, based on my research, in the tail end of the George Herbert Walker Bush administration, as some people may remember, we were really going through a drug epidemic, and a violent drug epidemic at that time. This would have been in 1988, I guess, in the late 80s. And Congress was under great pressure to do something about it. So they passed a bill very much against the wishes of the then Secretary of Defense, Frank Carlucci, that empowered the U.S. military to act as a gendarme in order to arrest the flow of drugs into this country. Now, this was in violation of something called posse comitatus, which is, I think it's a Civil War era piece of legislation which prevents the military or prohibits the military from acting as policemen in foreign lands. And that's one of the reasons why Carlucci opposed it. This came along with an authority to spend money, and it's an ongoing resolution that gets rolled over every few years. And the oversight is very lax, and so there's a great deal of room for abuse. Years later, under the Rumsfeld administration, the Rumsfeld tenure or era at the Pentagon, Donald Rumsfeld argued successfully for an expansion of that authority so that it was proprietary to the Pentagon. It obviated the need to go to the State Department for permission to spend money on a particular program or a project. And as of just last year, I think these ongoing provisions, spending authorities, had exceeded $1 trillion, and there's every reason to believe that it will continue to grow geometrically and with lax oversight.
But Stephen Glenn, nobody would claim that we're winning the war on drugs. And I suppose to some extent, is that the point, that it's just built this vast bureaucratic rice bowl?
Yes, absolutely. And it's an example of a policy becoming an end in itself, as opposed to a means to an end, which obviously the policy cannot reconcile. Right? And you're, of course, the war on drugs has been an abysmal failure. And it also shows the limits and the perils of using the military and a capacity beyond which our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines are trained to perform. It's a very dangerous thing to use the military in a cavalier way or in a way in which it's not meant to be used.
So Stephen Glenn, moving to the more recent disasters following the 9/11 attack and the militarization of the response and the steamrolling of Secretary of State Colin Powell in the run-up to the Iraq War, it always seems so clear to me that the evidence is so manifest here in terms of your book, you know, and your argument, State versus Defense, The Battle to Define America's Empire. Both the Iraq War and the Afghan War were quick victories followed by slow defeats. And where we lost was we lost on the Peace Corps end. We didn't deliver infrastructure, security, of course, is a big part of it. We didn't deliver electricity, all of the schools and all of this stuff that the Iraqis, by the way, had before we destroyed it. I mean,
right,
Afghanistan, maybe they never had it. Maybe we're wasting billions on mud brick villages there. But so walk us through that dysfunction, if you will.
Well, I think politically, it was unavoidable for the United States to respond militarily in Afghanistan to the 9/11 attacks because the attacks came with an address, effectively. We knew Al-Qaeda took responsibility for it. Al-Qaeda was in Afghanistan. They were allies of the Taliban. I personally don't see how any president could not have responded with an invasion and occupation. Unfortunately, of course, we dropped the ball and we plunged into Iraq. And of course, many books have been written on about how that happened. We know that Iraq was in President Bush's sights from the very beginning, while the embers were still burning at the World Trade Center. It was a vendetta for him. And which is a very poor foundation on which to build a policy. We know that the men and women who were charged with making policy in the run-up to the war had no knowledge whatsoever, knew nothing about Iraq or the Middle East or the Arab world or Islam, and it showed in the planning. We know that those who did know about the region, who had made a career out of living and working there, people like Ryan Crocker, who's a career diplomat and Arabist, wrote in a searing memo cable to the White House that not only would this be an unwinnable war, it would be waged at an enormous price both to the Iraqis and to the United States, even to the point of anticipating correctly a refugee crisis, sectarian violence, etc. So this is where I think the whole process of militarization reaches its crescendo, and we're still living with the consequences, and I think we will for some time.
So do you think that there's been any improvements made in terms of, obviously, the Pentagon gets the lion's share of the money, and, you know, we obviously are in a different era. We're not facing the Soviet enemy, and you know, we'll get to the idea of ginning up a Chinese enemy in a little bit, but the long and the short of it is you would think that we'd be more effective if we put the Peace Corps at the tip of the spear and delivered on some of these nation-building aspects rather than, you know, and also it seems like the military is at least changing to having more special forces units and less vast standing armies.
You mean the special forces units being more effective?
That seems to be, I mean, if you go back to the end of the Cold War where national security threats, national threats suddenly went away, and they've been replaced by subnational and transnational threats.
Right,
and that's
correct.
The new landscape. And, yeah. You know, it's like a big supertanker turning around. They're still fighting the last war, the Cold War, aren't they, the Pentagon?
Right. It's interesting. I think Joe Biden has been vindicated in a way by his endorsement of focusing on surgical strikes in Afghanistan in order to neutralize the threats there, as opposed to the McChrystal and Petraeus expansionist counterinsurgency campaign, which everyone has pretty much given up on. But you asked me if there's any cause for optimism. I don't. It's very difficult to be hopeful, because even as we talk about cutting the Defense Department's budget, which God knows there's a lot there to cut, we will also be doing the same thing to the State Department. So this spending imbalance of 12-1, basically spending $12 on the military for every $1 we spend on our diplomatic resources will probably be sustained. Nor do I hear a conversation in Washington about the need to maintain these Cold War deployments in Asia and Europe on behalf of allies who are rich, frankly. They have a high per capita income, and they have more than enough capacity to develop a credible deterrent to whatever threats they face without America's preponderant involvement. That's as so long as we don't discuss that, so long as we don't consider unwinding those Cold War commitments, those legacy commitments, we're still going to be on the hook for an enormous outlay.
Well, I guess, Stephen Glane, the most glaring example of what you're just talking about is NATO. That seems to be a relic in search of a mission.
I was in, and this is in the book, I covered NATO during the 1999 bombings of Serb positions in Kosovo, and it was just otherworldly, seeing these bureaucrats scampering around, trying to look busy on what was their first war, you know, in NATO's 60-year history. And it was clear to me that this was a like you say, a relic, an anachronism that had lost its way with the implosion of the Soviet Union. Now look at what's happening in Libya. The White House, I think, wisely backed away and said, we are not going to have anything to do with this. Then they were kind of dragged back in because of NATO's inadequacy to maintain an aerial bombardment on its own. But the results have just been a complete mess, and NATO, I think, has completely discredited itself, and it's time to liquidate it. But I don't hear that from people who matter, although you do hear it from people in Europe who know the weaknesses of NATO, they know the fallacy of NATO, and a few lonely voices here in the United States.
So, Stephen Glane, do you think that the debate over NATO getting involved in Libya at the time, where I talked to a lot of people on the right who were very upset and feel that we can't be the policemen, and so you had a kind of political flip where it was the liberal interventionists on the left want us to get in, and a lot of the military conservatives on the right who thought it was a bad idea. Where does that struggle stand?
Well, it's a good question. I think it shows you how sometimes it's civilians in the State Department who are endorsing a military or a militarized response to challenges abroad. Hillary Clinton, I think, is, at least in this case, she betrayed herself to be a liberal interventionist, or at least listening to those in her administration like Susan Rice and Anne-Marie Slaughter, who's since gone up back to Princeton. The siren call is very seductive. Well, we've got this military around we've got our assets around the world. There's a humanitarian crisis going on. We have to do something. So deploy, activate. And it doesn't always work out that way, as Robert Gates, I think, who has a long history in service, understood, and that's why he opposed it. And I think the events have vindicated him.
Well, he was pretty blunt. He said that anybody who wants to commit the U.S. military to another large land war needs to have their head examined. Of course, that was a play on what MacArthur had said way back about going to war against China. Not that MacArthur's not guilty.
That's the ultimate irony coming from him.
Exactly. But how do we deal? Just go to, taking the State Department side of the state versus defense battle that you've profiled in your new book, Stephen Glane, State versus Defense: The Battle to Define America's Empire. Clearly, though, since the end of the Cold War, all the wars that we've been involved in effectively, we've gone after criminals, some of whom are heads of state. The first one was under Bush's father, went into Panama to arrest one guy, killed a whole bunch of collateral damage there. Mm-hmm. The logic of freeing people by killing them, the only crime of the Panamanian people, the Iraqi people, the Yugoslavian people, was, to a less extent, because a lot of the Yugoslavs bought into their ethnic cleansing. But the long and short of it is, these people, their real crime is that they're victims of dictatorships. So why don't we go after the dictators? Why do we have to go to war with these countries rather than arrest these guys? I mean, how far along are we in forming some kind of international mechanism that we don't have to go to war against countries to free their people from predatory governments?
Well, I mean, you can look at Iraq from 1991 to 2001, where the solution was thought to be a crippling embargo, international embargo, on the entire country.
Which hurt the people, right? You know.
Right. Exactly. And
Saddam got rich. Saddam and his sons got even richer.
Absolutely. I mean, I used to go to Iraq while I was a foreign correspondent in the Middle East, and I would go there frequently, and it was just amazing to me how you could see the ill-gotten riches of the smuggling trade, and how it was creating this kleptocracy and turning middle class and white collar class Iraqis and the pimps and prostitutes. It was terrible. But I really don't see an alternative to. I don't see any good solution. I think there will always be dictators, and there will always be victims of dictators. The most powerful country in the world can do little to change that. If there was some kind of multilateral round that could conspire in effective ways to remove these hideous leaders, and then I'm all for it. And I'm all ears if someone has an idea for that. But I just don't see it. It's been with us since pre-biblical times, and I think it'll be with us at least for the foreseeable future.
Well, let's take a brief station break here, Stephen Glane, and we'll be back in a moment talking further about your important new book, State versus Defense: The Battle to Define America's Empire. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm speaking with author and journalist Stephen Glane, the author of an important new book, State versus Defense: The Battle to Define America's Empire. Before we get into the extent to which the empire is waning, we're maybe at the twilight here, and and the various, there have been, you know, Chalmers Johnson's wrote a number of, a trilogy of books, The Sorrows of Empire, etc. Could it be, though, that there's going to be a kind of a last gasp of empire here, with the extent to which the Pentagon apparently does not want to tolerate China emerging as a regional power? And as you know, China's economy is booming, mm-hmm. and just as a fraction of its GDP, they're going to be spending more on defense. It's inevitable. But clearly, the Pentagon doesn't wants to contain China, and they're now building a missile base on an island south of South Korea, which was a World Heritage Site, which they're screwing up. You know, clearly not aimed at North Korea, but aimed at containing China. So, where does the new arms race with China stand?
Well, we're already seeing it. The U.S. has been deploying materiel and weapons there for some time now to beef up their existing large footprint in Asia. And as someone who worked and lived in Korea and Japan, I can attest to that. It was already enormous, and it's getting larger now. Like you say, that they're building up Guam, they're building up Diego Garcia, they are apparently building a naval facility and missile site on Jeju Island, which is a beautiful island. I've been there several times. And it's very much being opposed by the local population, just as Okinawans opposed to the marine installations there. And China is responding in kind. It's developing sophisticated diesel-powered submarines. It just rolled out its first aircraft carrier, and I'm sure that it will be. I'm sure it has several carrier battle groups in the works. They're developing capabilities which can allows them at relatively low cost to themselves deny the American Navy access to what they call its green water sea lanes, which are right on the coast of China, just off of its international waters, which is a measurement that's very much in dispute between China and its neighbors and China and the U.S. So there already is an arms race. And lastly, I should point out that China apparently has developed the capability to target and destroy a carrier battle group, so just not just the aircraft carrier, but its support vessels, from a warhead that's deployed on a missile in space, and the warhead can be either conventional or non-conventional. As you can imagine, this is something that worries the Pentagon a great deal. So you have an arms race. You have increasingly sophisticated plans to sustain a war with China, however you want to define war. So I think we all know where this is heading, absent a robust diplomatic intervention.
So give us a sense then, given that your book, Stephen Glenn's State versus Defense, The Battle to Define America's Future, pretty much shows that the defense versus state, defense wins, is the serial winner here. Obviously, this more than ever needs to be avoided, a confrontation
of
with
course,
China.
Of course, and the Pentagon, the problem is both sides are talking past one another. The Pentagon is saying we welcome the peaceful rise of China, but we're not going to concede our traditional hegemonic control of the sea lanes anywhere in the world, including the South China Sea, where so many of these disputed areas lie. The Chinese are saying, this is our Monroe Doctrine. This is our manifest destiny. And we have 3,000 years, and for the last 3,000 years, Asia has largely been Sinocentric, so we are just trying to restore our authority in this area. I don't see any serious attempt to reconcile the gap between those two positions. It may be going on below the radar, and if so, I would welcome that. I think we all would. But absent that, like I say, that diplomatic intervention to diffuse these tinder boxes like the South China Sea and the disputed waterways between Korea and Japan and China, there does seem to be an inevitability of some kind of conflict.
But you have to, there's a surreal quality to this, though, Stephen Glenn, because this is a country that owns our debt, mm-hmm. that depends upon our markets, which are, you know, frankly drying up because the consumers in this country are running out of money. But nevertheless, that seems to be the deal. We open up our markets to you. We get hooked on your goods, which we get cheaper than we could make them, and you buy our debt.
Today.
Right.
That's the situation today. There is nothing preventing China from slowly, gradually, and hopefully in a transparent way, reducing its exposure to U.S. dollar-denominated securities, including the Treasury bills that keep our government going.
Well, after what these idiot Tea Party people just did on Capitol Hill, can you blame them?
No, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that just gave further impetus to Chinese concerns about the reliability of some of these so-called risk-averse instruments. But I think the investment fund houses in Wall Street are switching out of dollars and into a basket of currencies to hedge their positions. Now, it has to be said that the yields on U.S. treasuries are still low. That's because the rest of the world looks even worse than we do. But that's not always going to be the case. And I'm sure the Chinese who do tend to think strategically versus our tactical perspective are thinking ahead. I'm sure they're thinking about how they're going to slowly unwind their dollar holdings, if nothing else, so they could get a better return elsewhere. So I think we delude ourselves into or we lure ourselves into wishful thinking and this belief that so long as we are locked into this yin and yang embrace with China, they buy our debt, we buy their products, that we have nothing to fear. Because the Chinese, I'm sure, are thinking way beyond that. And keep in mind, Asia continues to evolve economically. It is going to be the richest place on Earth. And that is already becoming one of China's largest markets, and eventually it will eclipse the United States as its largest market.
Well, I guess when we talk about America's decline, I think you have to broaden it out a little bit, the decline of the West, because clearly what's happening in the Eurozone mirrors the same kind of economic distress we have here, although that's not to buy into this bogus debt argument that's been floated, that mm-hmm. our debt's unsustainable. Austerity is killing, policies are killing the European recovery, and they're going to kill our recovery. We're inflicting our own economic wounds at the moment, while the Asians are on a roll.
Yeah. Well, I'm not an economist, although I've written quite a bit about economics, especially in Asia, in emerging markets. And I don't think you have to be an economist to know that if you want to create jobs, you've got to spend money. And if the private sector is not doing the spending, then the government has to. But it appears that in this country, at least, there is the political environment militates against that. And so we're conversely embracing a austerity measures at a time when we need to create jobs.
So just to go back to the broader thesis of your new book, State versus Defense, The Battle to Define America's Empire, Stephen Glenn, given the idea that we're, I think in our subconscious we feel something like the twilight of empire here, what are the tough truths that you found that in writing this book that you feel that we have to grasp?
I think one of the most important lessons that I took away from reporting, researching this book, is always listen to your area expertise. Always listen to the people on the ground. If there is some kind of a challenge or a threat to U.S. interests overseas, then listen to the people who are there, who are sent there because they're experts on the source of the threat, whether it's the China hands in the 40s and 50s who were destroyed politically because what they saw on the ground contradicted what was politically popular here in Washington. To people like Ryan Crocker, the diplomat I spoke about earlier, who was a career Arabist and who warned about the dangers and perils and wrongheadedness about going into Iraq. So that, to me, of course, it seems very fundamental, doesn't it? But so powerful are the centrifugal political forces here in Washington that it's very rarely applied.
But Stephen, in a way, you're talking about a battle between intelligence and ignorance, and this is what concerns me, is that I believe the United States is getting more and more ignorant, and that just not just with the Tea Party right showing their economic illiteracy and believing in dinosaurs on Noah's Ark and all that strange anti-science stuff. But it's also, even on the left, you've got conspiracy theories about 9/11 and all this stuff, which are anti-intellectual, anti-medicine stuff is out there now. There's all kinds of stirrings in this country. And I wonder whether you can have an intelligent and deft foreign policy if, as a country, we're getting stupider.
Well, I think we're very parochial, certainly. Which, ironically, I think that the number of personalities or constituencies that are involved in making foreign policy is relatively limited, because it's foreign policy, and people who are concerned about where the next job or meal is coming from are going to excuse themselves from that discussion because they don't think it does not affect them directly. I think it's easier for groups who are playing an angle or who are just militarists to hijack the process simply by scaring the public through demagoguery and alarmist cant. That's a relatively easy thing to do. So it's a mix. It's a combustible mix of parochialism on the part of the American public, and a kind of a weariness with foreign adventures that they don't understand, and their susceptibility to alarmism, and their willingness to give the military whatever it thinks it needs in order to preempt these threats, in quotation marks. And a lack of curiosity. That to me is one of the most one of our biggest weaknesses. Is we're not curious about what's going on in other parts of the world. We don't take the time to educate ourselves, to learn how people live in overseas, what is the real character of these existential threats that we're told about, and why should we care? That's just my own personal opinion, because I as a correspondent, I had a kind of a built-in curiosity to go abroad and learn. And I only wish some of my compatriots had the same burning curiosity to know that I do.
Well, it's strange that we have a country right next door, Canada, that has a higher standard of living than we do, but we don't even know about it. We're told that they're actually suffering from having free health care. It does seem that there are walls built up here, walls of ignorance, if you will.
Yeah, I think we're victims of our geography, because we are effectively an island. We have two peaceful borders to the north and the south, and we have two enormous oceans to the east and the west. So as a result, we're insulated, and Canadians they know more about us than we know about them, because we're the most powerful country in the world. But we've been given the luxury of not only needing to know about the world, but we are so big and powerful and rich now that we can suffer or endure horrible experiences like Vietnam and Iraq, with relatively few in relatively good order.
Right, with little pain because we don't have the draft anymore, et cetera.
That's right, and we've segregated our military and civilian realms.
But let me focus in though, just in the last few minutes here, because I really feel your book's one of the most important pieces of work that I've seen lately, and particularly in terms of understanding where we stand in our foreign policy. Not that we don't have tremendous challenges with our domestic politics and our economy, but clearly, the real issue with America, the real struggle is, will the Republic survive the Empire? At least that's my analysis. And you know, the questions come up, is it, are we just bad at foreign policy, or is that a function of empire? And I recall Graham Fuller, senior CIA guy who was station chief in Kabul recently, in an interview with me, said, we just have to get out of these areas. Don't you understand that it's our footprint in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Iraq and other countries that are the problem? We'd have so much less problem if we simply weren't there. And it seems so clear to me that he was right, and yet it's not a debate that we're having.
Well, yeah, I make the exact same point in my book. I write that the military is not... The solution to the problem, or our deployments are not the solution to the problem. It is the problem. So I agree with him completely. And I again, we've become so used to maintaining this global empire, and it is an empire, that it's just become part of our identity. And as I point out in my book, when it became clear to me that America was represented abroad more by people in military uniform than in doctor smocks or engineering in engineering gear, and that we really have lost our Republican way and image, and I find that very disturbing, and that's why I wrote the book.
So does that mean then, Stephen Glenn, again, the author of State versus Defense, The Battle to Define America's Empire, does that mean then that it's actually patriotic to be anti-war? In other words, it's not just a moral position to take. It's also a pragmatic position to take because, the empire is killing the republic.
You mean... I'm sorry.
I'm saying, is it? Have we reached a point where it is not just a moral imperative, or not just a morally driven question to be against war and against empire?
Right.
It actually is a pragmatic position. This is the best way to save America, to save the American dream.
Yes, absolutely. But because a minority has made such a fetish out of the military and has been so astute at using it as a prop to make political statements, I think there still is a taboo to talk openly about unwinding our commitments overseas and to not necessarily identify American republicanism, small r, with the military. I think also we tend to overstate the importance of no longer becoming the world's greatest power. I don't really see that as symbolically, I suppose it's a feel-good issue. But, I've lived in worked in countries with very high standards of living and good medical care and working democracies and good schools and infrastructure. That are not global powers, and yet to me that's the most important thing for the health of any Republican democracy. It's not how many bases you have overseas; it's how many children you can educate to grow up to become responsible adults. Similarly, I don't see the existential crisis of no longer being the largest economy on Earth. It shouldn't be the size of your economy. It should be your standard of living. So I think we've just kind of deluded ourselves. We've adopted some some odd points of reference, or counterproductive points of reference, and over the last 60 years. And I think if we're going to climb our way out of this hole, we're going to have to rearrange them to make them more meaningful.
But meanwhile, the rest of the world is doing its own thing and moving ahead. China, of course, we've talked a lot about China as an emerging power, but there are other ascending powers like Brazil, India, Turkey, and South Africa. They're certainly not taking our economic model, our neoliberal economic model. And then we've also got the fact that the planet itself is showing signs of distress. And here we are going through this, you know, anti-science, enforced regime of denial and ignorance, mm-hmm. when a piece of the Antarctic the size of Rhode Island breaks off, when we're not supposed to connect that with global warming. I mean, what kind of role are we playing in terms of being, you know, stewards of this endangered planet?
Well, but that means Northern Crossing will be cleared for the first time in millions of years, and then we can exploit the mineral and petrochemical wealth that's underneath those ice caps.
Well, that's going to dig the hole deeper, surely.
Well, exactly. Of course, it just shows you how perverse the whole thing is. Another irony is that the Pentagon has become kind of on the cutting edge or the vanguard of developing fuel efficiencies, in part because it's so expensive to patrol the seaways and the air corridors and the land bridges. Which is good on them, although their motivation is somewhat unfortunate.
Well, just in the last minute or so, tell our audience here why this book is important. I know why it is, and I've attempted to do so, but I'd like to hear it from you.
I found it meaningful to write simply because it allowed me to understanding. It allowed me a better understanding of the vulnerability of our system to demagoguery and alarmism, and the consequences of that vulnerability. It gave me a better understanding of what the U.S. government has been doing in my name as a citizen. And I hope readers would appreciate the ramifications of having a diplomatic agencies and military ones that are so critically in such a state of critical disequilibrium and the unsustainability of that.
Well, Stephen Glane, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you, Ian. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Glane, who's a journalist and author. He wrote for the South China Morning Post before joining the Wall Street Journal, where he became a foreign correspondent covering Asia and the Middle East from bases in Seoul, Tokyo, Tel Aviv, and Amman. He's the author of Mullahs, Merchants, and Militants, The Economic Collapse of the Arab World, which was named the best book in 2004 by the online magazine The Globalist. And Stephen Glane's latest book is State versus Defense, The Battle to Define America's Empire. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.